So welcome to episode 4 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm the film watcher, Greg Rao.
This week we are going to have another 3 films to talk about. 2 confessionals, which we had from last week. Although I hadn't seen The Sound of Music.
Yeah, we'll come to that. And I had not seen Cabaret.
And the film we will be revisiting is Doctor Strangelove.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And while we're talking about worrying, I have to say I'm a bit worried that anybody listening to this is going to think that we like Nazis. Because we realised last time that Sound of Music and Cabaret were both musicals with Nazis in there somewhere. And it's only when I sat down to watch Strangelove, and I think you did too, we suddenly thought, more Nazis.
With Nazis, we had no idea.
So don't read our politics into this.
So, okay, let's talk about The Sound of Music, my confessional.
Yes, okay. So you might remember last time how amazed I was that Ricardo had not seen this film. But anyway, made in 1965 and based on a true story, The Sound of Music is possibly one of the most famous movies of the 20th century. And it's probably so famous that to tell the story is probably superfluous. But here we go. Maria, Julie Andrews, is training to become a nun in an abbey in pre-World War II Austria. And not very successfully, as she has a heart overflowing with joy and song. The mother abbess decides to give Maria a chance to reflect on her life's path. So Maria is sent as a temporary governess to the 7 children of decorated war hero and widower, Captain Von Trapp, Christopher Plummer. After a rocky start, Maria captivates the children because she brings music and joy to a house that has known sorrow. And this in turn melts the frozen heart of the captain so that he becomes open to the possibilities of love with Maria. This everyday love story forms the spine of the first 2 acts of the musical, boosted by cute children, beautiful locations across Salzburg, and countless memorable songs that you could probably hum without thinking too hard about it. But there's a third, darker act, as the newly married Von Trapps must decide what to do when the dominant Nazi party insists on the captain returning to duty in their service. So, Ricardo, I am waiting with bated breath. Sound of Music, how did you go?
I really loved it. It's a joy to watch this film. And look, I must say, I knew every song.
Every song?
Every song in there.
Something good?
Everything.
Okay.
Every song when it came up, I thought, I know this song. It's hard not to be surrounded by The Sound of Music throughout your life, but I just never watched it, okay? I'd actually set up a cinema at the Hamer Hall in Melbourne, which had the whole dress-up thing going on, and it was a whole celebration of The Sound of Music, and I didn't watch it that time anyway. I set up the cinema, but I didn't actually watch the film.
So you have a treat ahead of you. You need to go to Sing-Along Sound of Music.
I do have to go to Sing-Along Sound of Music now.
And dress up.
As a nun.
No. You have to wear the curtains turned into clothes.
Yeah.
That'd be the outfit to wear. Anyway.
But I'll tell you, from the opening, and everybody's seen that hill, the opening of The Sound of Music, I'd seen the remake, the recreation of it in National Lampoon's European Vacation with Chevy Chase.
I haven't seen this.
That's a recreation of the same hill, and he's on there singing The Hills of Alive with the sound of Griswold.
Okay. We are going from sublime to something.
We are, absolutely. But really, the opening is
Do you know the famous
glorious
story about that opening?
No.
So when she's on the hill turning around, just before we get the close-up of her, they came in by helicopter to film that scene.
Oh, it's an amazing shot.
And the chopper blades kept knocking Julie Andrews over. And she was trying to get them to come in a different way or something because she could not stand upright. And so she was about to say something and finally they managed to get it.
Oh, wow.
I think that's a beautiful story behind the moment.
It's a lovely love story. And the Von Trapp kids, I've been hearing about the Von Trapp kids, and they've been doing, where are the Von Trapp kids now sort of segments on Entertainment Tonight and these different things. And so I never really know what's so special about the Von Trapp kids, but they are really special. And Christopher Plummer, I've seen a lot of his older stuff, but I had no, he was wonderful. He was so different to anything he does now. He was very good in it.
And he didn't want to do it.
Really?
No, he almost had to be dragged into it, and he hasn't liked it since. He was told that he'd get to work on the character a bit more.
Well, he still doesn't like the film.
He's moved to the point where he understands it appeals to a lot of people. He says, look, I'm really pleased it does that, but it's not my cup of tea.
Amazing that you're saying that he doesn't really like the film. Mm. It's not his cup of tea, really. Because he's so good in it. He starts very, he's very hard line, very sort of a naval, he's a naval captain, and he's got his little whistle and he blows it when the kids are all in a line and they're all straight and boom. But then he really loosens up when Maria comes. But at the very end, after they're married and the Nazi party have ordered him to go away, when he's singing that final song on guitar.
Mm.
Which song is that? Actually, didn't.
Out of Ice.
Yes.
Yep.
It's wonderful. What a great performance.
Yes, but that's not the moment for me. The moment for me in the film, and I'd kind of forgotten until it happened, and I found myself getting teary.
Mm.
Is when his sorrow finally begins to melt. So he realises that his future is not with the Baroness.
Yes.
He hears his children singing after they've, you know, all fallen out of the boat and they're sopping wet. Yes. And they've gone and, you know, changed their clothes. And they're singing, I think they're singing The Sound of Music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, The Hills Are Alive, The Sound of Music.
Yeah.
But in a very different way. At the start, Maria is very kind of exuberant and, mm-hmm. you know, exultant. And this is a quieter, almost ballad kind of song.
Yeah.
And he slowly comes into the room and he looks at his children. I'm getting a bit quivery just thinking about it. He looks at his children and it shifts within him. And
yeah.
I don't know what he does, but you see it shift within him. And he comes in the room and he starts singing with them. And then the children all crowd around him.
That is a moment. That is a beautiful moment of the film.
Well, Charmian Carr, who played Liesl, the eldest daughter,
mm.
she talks about the fact that she got on very well with Christopher Plummer. In fact, probably a little bit too well. They quite liked each other.
Mm.
I think that was as far as it went. But she knew that he liked her. The other child actors, apparently, she says, did not know that. And at that moment, they really felt they bonded with Christopher Plummer. In fact, the child actors themselves, some of them were genuinely crying at that scene.
Well, Julie Andrews is just phenomenal in the role. Yeah. But all the songs, How Do You Solve a Problem, like Maria, was, you know, just so classic. So in Long, fact, Farewell.
In that How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria, I mean, there are some lovely lyrics here. Even that one about how do you hold a moonbeam in your hand?
Mm.
That's such a love. It's poetic.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing song.
And we should mention Rodgers and Hammerstein, who were the songwriter and, you know, and composer for this.
Mm.
You know, it's certainly up there amongst their greatest works, I think.
One thing I just didn't expect for it to do is take its darker turn in the third act.
Yeah.
I really didn't expect that. I knew that there was something, it was, you know, in terms of the rise of the Nazi party, but I didn't think it would go as dark or suspenseful as it got at the end. The bit when they're in the abbey
mm.
and they're hiding behind the stone.
Yeah, the graves.
The graves.
Yep.
Was really suspenseful and really, I thought this is really different to how this opened, you know.
And yet in the middle of that darkness is that very funny line where the youngest child, Gretel, says to Maria, should we start singing about our favourite things now?
That's right.
That cracked up my 10-year-old.
Yeah, loved yeah. it.
This film has never been popular in Germany and Austria, not least because of the things to do with the Nazis in the story.
Of course.
And in fact, when it was the first release in Germany, the local branch manager for 20th Century Fox authorised a cut version of the film where they took out the whole third act. It ended at the wedding
wow.
as the triumphal you know, conclusion of the film. The director, Robert Wise, got involved in this and they restored it, and that branch manager was fired because he'd taken away, I think, what really rounds it out from being you know, a beautiful story about love and family and sorrow and the need to sort of move beyond that sorrow into that darker part. And the one thing that I had forgotten is that I remembered that Rolf, the telegram boy, who's the love of
yes.
young Liesl,
yeah.
I remembered that he had turned on them. What I'd forgotten was that Franz the butler was part of that as well. So early in the film, Franz says to Rolf when he first comes to the house, something about, you know, what's going on. So they're obviously talking about this stuff together. And when they're sneaking out of the house, pushing the car quietly to make their escape, and the police yes. or the Nazis, whatever, are there waiting for them, and you see Franz watching from the window just for, you know, a few seconds, and it's quite clear, although, as I say, I'd forgotten, it's quite clear that Franz has dobbed them in.
Yeah,
he's run
right.
the police, and that's
yeah.
why they are there. So that whole idea of people who were at the bosom of your family turning on each other is there. And the politics and the darker side of the story have been lightened for the film. I grew up with the soundtrack. My parents had the record of the old stage show. Mm. I think it might have been the original Mary Martin one. And there are two songs that are cut from there. And interestingly, they're both the songs sung by the Baroness.
Right.
And one of them is called No Way to Stop It. And it's all about the Baroness and Max trying to convince the captain that the only way to get through things is to just pretend to go along with them.
Mm.
Be non-committal, just sort of smile and go with it. But it's going to happen anyway. In the same way that planets go around the sun and so on, it's inevitable and you just have to accept it and go forward. And in that song, Captain Von Trapp is saying, well, no, I don't go along with this. And in fact, that becomes the reason for why the captain and the Baroness don't have a future together.
Yeah, right.
And that's when he starts to tune in more to Maria. Whereas in the film, that part's taken away. Mm. It's more about the Baroness just isn't quite the right woman for him. And that policy has been softened, but it's still there. And I think that makes it a more interesting film.
Look, I thought it was a wonderful film. I really did. Now, if I'm going to rate it,
mm-hmm.
it is a classic of cinema. I loved it a lot. It's not a 10. I'm going to give it an 8.
An 8.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for me it's a 9.
Okay.
It kind of edges towards 10, but as I've said before, for me a 9 is something which is really at the top of its genre. I think Sound of Music absolutely is.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't quite reach 10 for me, because 10 for me is something which either transcends its genre or changes the way you think about something.
Yep.
And embedded, though, in our kind of popular consciousness, I think Sound of Music is. I don't think it quite makes that leap. So for me, a 9.
Well, an 8 is great.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh,
I did love it, but it's just an 8. It's just, yeah.
And maybe as you watch the next 28 times, that score might creep up.
To a 9. Possibly.
Possibly.
So the next confessional we have is that Greg hadn't seen Cabaret.
Which is one of your favourites, isn't it?
It is. Premiering in 1972, Cabaret is set in Berlin, Germany, in 1931, during the last days of the Weimar Republic era. American cabaret singer Sally Bowles, Liza Minnelli, meets a British academic, Brian Roberts, Michael York, who is on the verge of finishing university. The pair become lovers, despite Brian's confusion over his sexuality, but the arrival of the wealthy playboy, Maximilian, complicates matters for them both. This love triangle plays out against the rise of the Nazi Party. Defining and decadent, Cabaret was made by director and choreographer Bob Fosse and coined the phrase, "Life is a cabaret." So, Greg, what did you think?
I did not like this film. I so did not like this film. And I suspect I'm in a small minority for this.
How
and
could I know, you not I know like
that,
this film
I know
now.
That this is a favourite film of other people. I've talked about it at work, and one person said, my all-time favourite, and another said, yeah, absolutely right up there for me. And for me, it's like, really?
Really?
Really. Oh, well, look, where do I start?
You have to explain yourself.
I know. Well, look, I thought it had some really quite good moments. So the part where the three people, Maximilian, Brian and Sally,
yeah.
were sort of hugging. Brian's a bit drunk. They're hugging and kind of spinning in a circle.
Yeah.
And whatever was happening there at the camera, you knew quite clearly at that stage that this was a bisexual love triangle.
Yes.
And that, I thought, was done quite skillfully.
Very brave in the time it was made.
Yes. And I want to come back to that comment, because I think that's at the heart of why perhaps some people love it and I just don't. The other good moment was in the song Tomorrow Belongs to Me, which is where a lot of people, you know, at this country pub, I guess we should say beer garden for the Germans,
yeah,
but
right.
they one by one stand up and join the Nazi youth singing this song about, you know, the glorious Nazi regime.
The way that is shot, and the first time you see this really, you hear this beautiful voice in the background, this gorgeous voice singing this song,
and it's a close
and
up.
It's
of
a close
the,
up
of
this guy singing, and then and as the camera sort of draws back and then drops, you see the swastika on the arm. So it's quite chilling.
Oh, look, absolutely. Although I have to say, I knew about that one part of the film. Someone had told me years ago about that part, so I knew it was coming. But I get that. And there was a moment in that same sequence where there's an old guy who I think is the only one, apart from the main characters, who doesn't stand and is almost sitting there scratching his head.
Mm.
But the camera work there annoyed me as well. It was like there was too much sort of close-ups of individuals and not enough sense of standing back and seeing what was going on. So it annoyed me. But there were those moments that I thought were really quite good. But overall, no, it didn't work for me. I do not think Liza Minnelli is a good actress.
Oh!
No.
Hang on a minute. She is wonderful in this film. I think everybody's... Let me tell you what I think about this film.
No, I haven't finished yet.
Okay, hang on a minute.
All right, go on.
This is a classic. It won 8 Oscars.
Yeah.
Okay. Look, you know, I'm a massive fan of The Godfather, right, which actually got Best Picture that year in 1972. And
which did?
The Godfather won Best Picture.
Okay.
Right? Cabaret had swept the Academy Awards that year. I always thought to myself, before I'd seen Cabaret, how did Francis Ford Coppola not win for The Godfather? So when I saw Cabaret, I thought, that's why. That is superbly directed. Directed movie. It's actually near on perfect. It is a brilliantly made movie. From the start, with the sliding of the glass, to the end, to that chilling when it just stops on the Nazi symbol at the end, it threw in the glass. Amazing, rounded film.
I let me keep going. I don't think Liza Minnelli can act. I think she can sing.
Ooh.
And I love that song. I hadn't realised it was from Cabaret, but the one Maybe This Time.
Yeah.
Done superbly. And you can absolutely see that she's Judy Garland's daughter.
Mm.
So I think... Look.
Amazing. She actually sounds like Judy Garland.
I know.
So much during it. Sometimes I feel like she's going to say Toto or something. She's like, oh my God.
Judy Garland did do Merrill and the Wizard of Oz. But I know. I will continue.
Yeah.
So it... So she can certainly sing, and some songs I thought were more powerful than others, but, you know, that's the way of things.
Mm.
She cannot act. I didn't believe her and Brian. I didn't care about them. I really didn't. I became obsessed with the fact that she almost never blinks with all that, you know, heavy eye makeup, and that her idea of shades of tone was, you know, to cry and so on. It didn't feel real. I actually cared more about the story between Fritz and Natalia, the Jewish couple.
Yes, yeah.
And I would have liked to know more about them. Interestingly, there's no songs around them.
No, there's not.
And you know what's going to happen to them. They're either going to get out of Berlin or they're probably going to go off to the camps. And so there's a whole story there that you don't hear and you can kind of guess.
Mm.
But I found their story and Fritz's struggle with the ability to declare who he really is and what that might mean for him as a real struggle.
That's right.
And I love the moment when he first meets her over, I think it's tea, at the English tutorial, where he just pulls down his jacket to hide his worn shirt cuff.
Mm.
So again, there were moments in it, but no, it just didn't work. And
Joel Grey.
No, oh no, I don't understand why people love him. He only sang, and I saw something somewhere.
He was wonderful.
No, oh no, he was. I know he's been talked about as, you know, cold and creepily in control of things and so on. I saw him as neurotic. I'm sorry. I don't understand why this film did so well. I suspect... I suspect what's going on here, and this is not about you, this is, I think, about more people, is a lot of people who love this film would have seen it when it first came out, and I think in its moment, it was quite startling, transgressive, different in style.
It was boundary pushing.
Yeah, okay. Case in point, it talks about abortion.
Yes,
but I didn't believe. I just didn't feel that Sally. I didn't understand why she would do it. Why she would think he would accept that. I just felt like I was ticking boxes.
Well, they weren't. They were never going to be together.
Yeah, but that's okay. I just didn't believe the journey they went on to be together. Oh, I kind of believe that. But then that they weren't together, it just did not work for me. I think Bob Fosse's done better films. And I'm not necessarily a fan of his films. And I'm going to shock you here too, probably. I only seen bits of it, but I don't like The Little Prince.
Right.
But what I do like, what I really like, is All That Jazz. Which I saw, I think, when it first came out.
Yeah, that's...
And there, I thought it was a more integrated story. It was actually Bob Fosse's story. You know, that's who...
it is, yeah.
What's his name? The lead actor, Roy Scheider.
Roy Scheider
plays basically Bob Fosse in the story.
I really like All That Jazz.
Yeah, and it moves from reality to fantasy after he's had his heart attacks.
It does, but it's nowhere near on Cabaret.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, I disagree. I think All That Jazz is probably up around, for example, an 8 or 9.
Oh, money makes the world go. What a fantastic sequence. And when he says that if you could see it through my eyes, the moment when Joel Grey, you wouldn't be Jewish at all.
Yeah, that wasn't bad, but at that stage I was kind of over the film. I mean, there's that great line in there where Michael York says, "Screw Maximilian."
Yeah.
And Liza Minnelli says, "I do." And then he says, So do I. And again, there were good moments, but as a film for me, no.
You really didn't
I really didn't like it.
No, you didn't see it. Whereas when I first saw it, I remember I first saw it probably 20 years ago, right? Oh, actually about 18 years ago.
At the cinema?
No. It was 1972. It came out.
No, but it could have been the Astor.
No, I saw it on video, on VHS.
Oh, goodness.
And it blew me away.
I wouldn't care.
It was right there.
I wouldn't care if I never saw it again. Sorry.
Okay. So we're disagreeing on this one.
Oh, we are so disagreeing. This might be my revenge to forget Paris.
I just want to also say that the music was by Kander and Ebb.
Well, I just want to say that there's a connection between Cabaret and The Sound of Music, a very loose one. Liza Minnelli auditioned for Liesl. I cannot imagine Liza Minnelli as Liesl, because I think Charmian Carr, and it's one of only two parts I think she ever played.
Mm.
The other one, curiously, was a musical with Anthony Perkins.
Oh, wow.
Made for TV. That's another story. I thought she was perfect in the part, just light, graceful, totally believable in 16 going on 17. I cannot see Liza Minnelli in that. She would have made it brassy.
I don't think that's a Liza Minnelli part. But I disagree with you about her performance, her acting. I think she's beautiful and gorgeous in the film. But her stage presence as well is... I mean, I find the film... I mean, all of the routines and the dance numbers and the songs, they're quite sexy.
I disagree here too. Yeah. I recognise, for example, the chorus numbers.
Extremely sexy.
Some of those hip movements the chorus women were doing.
Yeah.
I looked at it and thought, this is classic Bob Fosse. But I actually think the dance sequence in All That Jazz, the erotic stewardess fly with us kind of number, I think that's sexier. Even though it's probably a little bit dated now as well. Now, I suspect that Cabaret would be much better on stage. But as a film, no, sorry, not for me.
I think on stage it'd be fantastic, but I think the film is...
I found it choppy and...
Well, there was the point of it, really. There's that manic nature of the rise of this party.
No, I didn't feel manic, it felt amateur.
No!
We are never going to go and see this film together, because I fully intend never to see it again, as a film at least.
Your rating?
4.
Oh!
And it's only a 4... because I can recognise in its time it might have been really quite something else. But watching it now, watching it fresh, because I didn't know a lot about this film other than Baby It Was About and that song Tomorrow Belongs to Me. But no, I'm going to give it 4.
10.
Well, there we go.
I think this film is beautifully directed. It's camera work, the way Bob Fosse uses the camera in it, the performances, the flow from the start to the finish is... he's on perfection. Look, I think it's a 10. It's a classic.
We're disagreeing, but maybe one day we can kiss and make up by talking about All That Jazz. Okay, so our revision exercise, to go back and watch a film we've both seen before, this time is Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. So what's it about? Well, just the name of Jack D. Ripper should have been warning enough for the people around him. But no one realises that the Brigadier General has gone quietly insane, to the point where he sends a squadron of nuclear-armed planes to bomb Russia. He does this in the belief that the commies are poisoning the precious bodily fluids of Americans through the fluoridation of water, a realisation he's reached at the height of lovemaking. This sets the tone for a dread-filled, almost documentary-style film that gradually becomes more and more lunatic, as the US president and his war room try to prevent this Holocaust or at least take advantage of it. Peter Sellers is notable here for playing three quite different parts, including the president and a mad ex-Nazi scientist. And yes, so we're back to the Nazis again. Sorry about that. This 1964 film was directed and co-written by Stanley Kubrick. It would almost stand out as a screwball comedy amongst Kubrick's works, were it not for its serious undertones. So, Ricardo, what do you reckon?
You know, I'm a really big fan of Kubrick. I really love all of his work from even the earlier Killer's Kiss. And look, this is it's a real piece. Like, it's a really good, great anti-war film, just to really show the lunacy, of military and American military.
And the lunacy is not just confined to Jack D. Ripper, But
no,
it becomes
no.
much more apparent in the George C. Scott character,
yes.
Who at first seems quite reasonable,
mm.
and then increasingly just becomes more and more, well, lunatic.
On a first watching, I think some people who tend to sort of now tend to watch it and just hear a lot of words being said and don't really get it or find the humour in it as much because it's played so seriously.
Well, it's slow burn. You know, this is supposed to be a film that we go back and watch, but I'm not entirely sure I've actually seen all of it before.
Mm.
I thought I had, but I don't think I actually have. And what struck me as I was watching it is that the first real joke or flag about the lunacy, which is the Brigadier General talking about the fluoridation of the water, is at about the 25-minute mark.
Yeah.
The only kind of joke before that is when you see his nameplate, if you're watching carefully, Jack the Ripper, and you think, okay, that's a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, no one around him kind of thinks, oh, that's not a very healthy name.
Yeah.
But the first 25 minutes or so is like almost a B-grade 1950s black and white film.
Well, it's a lot subtler than a lot of films, say, nowadays do. I mean, if you look at nowadays or films which are sort of making a bit of a mockery of the military and war, mm. It's films like Starship Troopers, which is the Paul Verhoeven film.
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
I'm a wuss.
But, okay. But Starship Troopers does it very much over the top, you know, whereas this is a lot subtler than that. And I think it's, you know, there's a really fine line between drama and comedy. If you play too much of the drama in the comedy, it's just a drama, right? But if you go too over the top, then it becomes screwball.
Yeah.
Kubrick puts it on the line through this. And I think during the very beginning of it, some people would think that it's quite serious, but then you sort of start getting that this is really a piss take. And then it just gets more sillier and sillier. And then when you meet Dr. Strangelove and his whole hearty, my name...
Strangelove for me was a little bit over the top.
He's meant to be.
Yeah, I know. But that was just that little bit too much for me. But go back to what you were saying earlier about the build-up. In fact, in that first half hour or so, I actually felt a rising sense of dread.
Mm.
Have you seen Failsafe?
No.
So Failsafe is a film that was made at the same time,
mm.
based on a book which the Strangelove author claimed was a rip-off that went to court and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Failsafe was made at the same time under the auspices of the same studio. In fact, it ended up being kept over because the films were seen as being too similar. I saw Failsafe, easily 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It's the same scenario, but it's not a comedy, it's not a satire, it's really quite awful. In fact, it has in some ways a much darker, it does have a much darker ending. And watching the beginning of Kubrick, Failsafe was very much in my mind.
Right.
And the sense that, you know, I'm not sure we really know how close in real life we've come to that scenario.
Mm.
And it's interesting how Kubrick's film starts with that disclaimer.
Yes, you know, it does.
The Air Force says this can't possibly happen.
Yeah.
And then did you recognise the title music at the start?
No.
I'm pretty sure it was Try a Little Tenderness.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it begins and ends with very savvy song choices. So, it ends, I think we have to do a spoiler here.
We'll meet again.
Yeah, I didn't realize this was a singing podcast. But you've got Vera Lynn singing that World War II classic, We'll Meet Again, over the sight of the world basically combusting.
Yeah.
And that.
Which is and this idea, what an amazing ending.
But
really,
it wasn't the original ending. I think we've talked about this. The original ending was a pie fight in the war room.
Oh, I have heard about this.
And it was, it's been rarely seen. I've seen the images of it.
I've seen a photo from it. Of George C. Scott with a
covered in pie cream stuff.
That would have been, the ending now is perfect, okay, for it. But I don't know how the pie fight would turn out, but maybe it was great.
I'd like to see it to compare it in my mind.
Mm.
But I suspect that would have just made it slapstick rather than, again, coming back to the awfulness of the premise of the film.
And obviously the Slim Pickens riding the bomb.
Oh, that's an iconic scene. He didn't know he was in a comedy. Kubrick didn't tell him.
But do you notice who else was who was in the plane as
I
well?
I do. First film debut was James Earl Jones.
Absolutely. I never knew that until I rewatched that.
I saw him in the titles.
Yeah.
and then was watching out for him. But yeah, like a great, you know, starting point for someone who's become so well known.
Oh, first of all, yeah, let's go.
And he certainly wasn't doing the heavy breathing at that stage for Darth Vader.
No, he wasn't. The voice was there though. It was a bit higher, the voice.
Yeah, well, he was younger, obviously.
Yeah, but you know who I really love in it? Sterling Hayden. I'm a very big fan of Sterling Hayden. He plays the General Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
I first, when I was younger and I watched The Godfather, as an Italian boy and I grew up watching The Godfather very young, he was the police captain.
Oh, okay.
In The Godfather. And I thought he was awesome as the police captain. What a bastard.
Mm.
But then when I started getting into Kubrick films and he was, you know, he was in The Killing.
Yeah.
Which was, I think it's an amazing movie as well, which Kubrick did. It was before this. Kubrick
obviously had actors he liked, because Peter Sellers was in Lolita, wasn't he?
Yeah, but you know, the one thing about Lolita is, I mean, I think Lolita is a fantastic Kubrick film. I mean, and one thing about Kubrick films, another thing I'll get to Dr. Strangelove as well, because it's with all of his films, the way Kubrick directs the actors in a very naturalistic way.
Mm.
When you watch a Kubrick film like Lolita or you watch Dr. Strangelove, they are playing it quite straight and naturalistic, whereas other films of the time were very much sort of like, hey, Marge, how are you? What you doing over there? Hey, you going over there, Mal? Oh, come on, come on. You know, that sort of over the top. So it was a really specific style of acting back then, whereas Kubrick was, his performances were really naturalistic.
Well, the great thing about Sterling Hayden's performance is he's playing someone who is quite odd,
yeah,
but he plays it straight, he plays it believably,
mm-hmm.
and he's quite logical in his rationale for what's going on. And you see Peter Sellers as in one of his roles as the British, you know, officer who's doing a placement there, whatever it is, and you can see he's quite trying to jolly him along and pretend he's buying into that false logic as a way of trying to get out of him. What's this three-letter code to try and stop everything happening? And we have to talk about Peter Sellers in this. He's brilliant. I say,
in all three roles, he's wonderful. I think as Dr. Strangelove, he is perfect, and he's so funny in it. And his timing, his physical body, the way he moves, his movement.
No, you know, see, I thought he was funnier as the president.
Oh, he's very. And that scene with the phone when he's speaking to
the Russian premier,
the Russian
kiss
premier.
Off, another
kiss off.
But it's almost like he's reassuring an old lover or something. You know, I do love you. I care for you. And no, it is important to me, you know, how you're feeling about this with the drunken premier on the phone.
I'm not as sorry as you are.
And he begins in that role as being very strict and stern moral in terms of, well, you told me this couldn't happen. How are we doing this? Why aren't you doing that? And then again, this sort of gradual transition where he's having these conversations with Kissoff to say, you know, and it's like talking to your wife almost from that era, you know, but I do care, you know, this is important, and almost there. And then he starts buying this whole scenario of, well, it's going to be bad. We could all go down to a mine shaft and have nubile young women serving us, you know, 10 each to create the next generation. And he's really into that.
Yeah. Oh, look, he's wonderful, and I think in every role here, but I think that him as Dr. Strangelove and the President are the best. When the Mandrake is a bit lesser, but he's still wonderful. But I think I think Peter Sellers suits this Kubrick film. In Lolita, as Quilty, he played Quilty in Lolita, he's only in a scene in that movie, or really in a couple of scenes, and I think he's way over the top in Lolita, whereas that's played so understated and naturalistic in the performances there, whereas I think when it goes to that scene with Quilty, it's way over the top, and I think he pretty much spoils it. But he's perfect for Dr. Strangelove. I think it is a classic. It deserves to be a classic. I don't think it's Kubrick's best. I think The Paths of Glory still stands as in terms of an anti-war film, and he does his anti-war films. I mean, he did Dr. Strangelove, there was Paths of Glory, and also Full Metal Jacket in his war trilogy. I think Paths of Glory is the best. It's his second, and Full Metal Jacket third. Other people would probably disagree with me on that, because I know a lot of people love Full Metal Jacket, as I do, but I think that's the order of it in my preference. So a rating on this one, what would you give it, Greg?
I feel like I should do a drum roll, because I'm going to say 10. This is my first 10. I really kind of ummed and ahed about it. You know, I thought, is it an 8 or 9? But the reason it pushes it up to a 10 for me is because, again, I think it does something quite unusual and really transcends, you know, say it's not quite a drama, it's not quite a screwball comedy. You know, it moves from one to the other, and it kind of flits between them a bit as well. And I think it gets that balance really, really right. And I think it was at its time, and I think still something that puts a really bad scenario in front of you and says, look how this could happen.
Yeah.
And it does that. There's a few little moments that jar. So I'm not as strong as you on Sellers as Strange Love. I just thought it got a little bit over the top. Mm. And you can see the Russian ambassador laugh at one point when Sellers' arm's going ballistic, trying not to do the Nazi salute.
And then he bites his hand at one point. He bites his fist at one point. So apparently Kubrick just let him go.
Yeah, well, no, he didn't. Yeah. Strangelove, maybe. But apparently he originally started playing the president with having a bad cold. And everyone was cracking up about it. But in the end, they decided that was a bit too much. Kubrick, or maybe Sellers himself, pulled that back.
Kubrick was a very big fan of Sellers.
Yeah, so in giving this a 10, I'm not sure it's a film I'd sit down and watch again and again and again in that sense of having a genuine love for it.
Oh, I think you get more out of it every time you watch it. I think because some of the screenplay gets lost. I think you just keep on listening. You're sort of not sure what's going on. And I think
probably true, but I'm not sure I'd gravitate naturally back to it.
Yeah, sure.
In a way, but I would, you know, how many times have I seen Sound of Music or Field of Dreams, for example.
Of course,
So don't I go back to it thinking, oh, I really want to see this film because I love this film and I love how I feel when I watch it. But I think it's, you know, master craftsmanship. So, yeah, I'm going 10. What about you?
I'm going a 9. Look, it's a classic and I feel bad not giving it a 10. But I think in terms of the Kubrick films, I think Paths of Glory tops it in terms of the
animal
film.
They can both be 10s. They don't have to be.
I know. I know, but I still think it's a 9. So that concludes episode 4 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
A bit of controversy about
Just
Cabaret.
A little bit. I'm still shocked about Cabaret, to tell you the truth. I'm still shocked you gave it a 4. I'm really shocked about it.
But the good news is I brought you into the fold with The Sound of Music.
Yeah, well, it's now a film I can watch. I can let my son watch now and we can watch it together and it'll be a nice family film, I think.
So next time, anyway, we're going to move beyond the Nazis.
That's right.
So your confession next time is I want you to watch Rashomon.
Yeah.
One of the great films of cinema, as well as, you know, Japanese cinema, I think world cinema. And for me?
Your one is Chaplin's Modern Times, which, you know, as a Chaplin fanatic, I just love Chaplin.
I don't know if I've seen any non-silent Chaplin, so this will be interesting.
You haven't seen any, okay, non-silent Chaplin?
I don't think so. I've seen some silent. I've seen more Buster Keaton, but I...
Modern Times is silent.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Okay, I haven't seen some of his great silent works either.
Yeah,
1936, okay, yes, that makes sense.
Well, the first time the tramp talks was in The Great Dictator.
Okay.
So it was the only time.
You're back to Nazis again.
Back to
Let's
Nazis.
Move on.
We're not going
to
go back. We're not going to review The Great Dictator, even though it'd be wonderful to review.
And our revision film, the one we're going to go back to, and it's way overdue that we should be looking at an Australian film, as proud Aussies. We're going to look at Lantana, 2001.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about that one.
I think we've talked about this, that we both loved it, but we don't actually remember much about it, so that it will be interesting again.
Well, it came out in 2001. That was the last time I saw it at the cinema, and I haven't seen it since. So
we'll see.
See you next time.
Indeed.